From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Donald Trump takes to Twitter and threatens GM with a big border tax.
I think it's GM's turn to be in his crosshairs.
Plus, a Muslim's view about why Trump voters put him into the White House.
I can see how easy it is to fall back into a bubble because it is comfortable, it is warm, it is cushy. But I also find that long-term, it is fatal.
Gerrymandering and its impact on Michigan politics.
Gerrymandered districts are, I call them breeding grounds for insane politicians.
And using nature as a model to build machines with artificial intelligence.
I'm not trying to construct something from scratch. I'm trying to evolve these artificial intelligences because evolution is the process that already gave rise to our intelligence.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Armed with Twitter, President-elect Donald Trump went after Ford throughout the campaign for making cars in Mexico. Well, now it's GM's turn to be in his crosshairs. Today on Stateside, we'll talk about Mr. Trump's latest tangle with the auto industry. But first, in March 1812, the Boston Gazette printed a political cartoon that showed the bizarre, twisted shape of a newly redrawn election district. The paper was responding to redrawing of the Massachusetts State Senate districts. It was pushed through by Governor Elbridge Gerry. The redistricting certainly benefited the governor's Democratic-Republican Party. The Gazette cartoonist thought one of those redrawn districts resembled a salamander. So he drew the district as a monstrous salamander with horned wings, fangs, and a viper's tongue. And in a hat tip to the governor, he called it gerrymander. That word is still used today when the majority political party draws the electoral map in its favor. My next guest has been digging into what this is looking like in Michigan these days. Tom Perkins' recent piece for the Metro Times is titled, "Once Again, Michigan Dems Receive More Votes in the State House, But Republicans Hold On to Power." Tom Perkins, welcome.
Thank you.
Michigan's new legislature is being sworn in on January 11th. You've been digging into the raw vote total from the November election that put those folks there. And what do the numbers tell us?
What they tell us is Democratic and Republican candidates for the state house races basically received the same number of votes statewide, about 2.3 million. But Republicans hold on to a 63-47 majority.
And behind that, at the base of that, is something that happened several years ago, isn't it?
Right. And around 2010, Republicans redrew the legislative districts. In Michigan, the party that's in power every 10 years is in charge of drawing the districts. So what they did was draw them in their favor. In Michigan, whoever controls more legislative districts has power, meaning they write and pass the laws. So gerrymandering is the art of drawing legislative districts so that Republican voters are spread among as many districts as possible, while Democrats are packed into as few districts as possible. That creates scenarios like we've seen the last couple election cycles where Democrats may receive more votes, but Republicans hold a majority. So even if voters want Democrats writing the laws, it's Republicans who control the process.
And as you point out in your piece for Metro Times in November, right after the election, here you find an advantage of about 18,000 votes for Democrats, according to the numbers posted right there on the website for the Michigan Secretary of State for House of Representative candidates.
Right. And I should note that it does include totals from a special election. If you don't include the special election, Republicans hold about a 4,000 vote majority, but it still doesn't change that the vote total is not representative of what voters want to see.
And from this packing and stacking that we've seen through the redrawing of districts in 2010, what are we getting in terms of legislation?
Well, basically what happens is Republicans can pass laws that are unpopular, but it's difficult to vote them out of office. You start seeing laws that are maybe more in line with Mississippi than Michigan, but because Republicans are insulated from voter anger, they can push through a deeply conservative agenda that's highly unpopular, but they won't be voted out of office.
For instance, what are some of the actions that you could point to?
Well, the emergency financial manager law was highly unpopular, and yet there was really nothing that voters could do about that.
Meaning that the voters rejected it in November of 2012, and within 2 months we had a brand new one with an appropriation attached, so nobody could, it was referendum proof.
Right, right. And in a normal democracy, the appropriate response would be then to vote the lawmakers who passed that out of office. But the way the districts are drawn, there are so many Republican, there's so many districts that hold a huge majority of Republican voters that Democrats, centrists, can't vote the Republicans who pass this law over voter objections out of office.
You also make a point, Tom Perkins, in your piece for Metro Times about the kind of politicians that this is generating. Want to talk a little more about that?
Right. Yeah. Gerrymandered districts are, I call them breeding grounds for insane politicians. You get people like Todd Corser or Cindy Gamrat. You know, how long do you think they would have lasted behaving like that had they faced any serious competition from a Democrat? Their base had their back, and they could get away with basically doing whatever they wanted. It took a long time to remove them from office. Had they faced stiff competition, they would have been out a lot sooner. We wouldn't have had that situation. You have guys like Dave Eggema. He was a Tea Party Republican from the Grand Rapids area, served between 2007 and 2013, who used to quote KKK leaders on his social media accounts. He was an overt racist, but you know, there was nothing that anybody could do to get him out of office.
Well, indeed, he was sent off to the Republican National Committee.
Right, right. So those are the kind of candidates you get. They're extremists, and there's not much that voters can do to remove them from office.
In your piece, you state gerrymandering is, and I'm using your quote, a legal form of election theft.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning?
It tilts things so far. It gives such an advantage to the party in power that it's nearly impossible for minority, in this case Democrats, to win back control of the House or the Senate, even if a majority of voters want to see the minority party, in this case the Democrats, back in power.
So do we have it de facto? Do we have a one-party government?
It's starting to look that way.
And does the general public have a grasp of this? I mean, I'm wondering, what do opinion polls tell us?
I talked to the Leave Women Voters. They had 70 meetings across Michigan last year in which they met with voters and talked about redistricting and redistricting issues. And, you know, Sue Smith, the league's vice president for redistricting, said that people really, you know, they just, it's not an issue that they understand. They don't particularly, at least in Michigan anyway, they don't particularly care about it because they don't see the connection between gerrymandering and the laws that are being passed. They don't see how the issue directly impacts their life. And it is a little bit complicated. It's not totally direct. You have to connect A to B to C. But once you do that and once you see how it works, it's pretty obvious that this is a problem.
And indeed, looking outside of Michigan, this type of redistricting is also being challenged elsewhere, particularly in Wisconsin?
Right, right. In Wisconsin and North Carolina, courts have found that gerrymandered districts are illegal. In Arizona, voters established a nonpartisan redistricting commission that Republicans fought tooth and nail, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that it's legal. So they had, in Arizona, you had a situation very similar to what we have in Michigan, and now there's a nonpartisan redistricting commission that draws up the districts, and it's much more balanced.
So would that decision stand if there was a challenge here, or would the fact that President-elect Trump is coming in and getting a chance to shape the Supreme Court, could that affect any future challenges?
Well, I suspect it would stand. But it definitely throws that into doubt.
Now, when are we due for another redrawing of the district boundaries in Michigan?
2020, I believe.
Yes. Every 10 years, right?
Right, right. And I don't think the new rules will go into effect until 2022.
So for those who are happy with the GOP approach to Michigan's issues, this is all working fine. But for people who voted for Democratic candidates, so feel they're not getting the state government they voted for, is there absolutely anything they can do about this?
Well, they can organize, start a petition drive to put a nonpartisan redistricting commission on the ballot. And, you know, it's something that voters would likely approve as long as there's a strong education campaign. And, you know, I talked to a few Democratic leaders, and they say somebody really needs to bankroll the effort, somebody like a Michael Moore, somebody who has a lot of money. And so far, nobody's really stepping forward. So, you know, I think that it's just a matter of organizing, finding somebody to bankroll an effort to get the issue on the ballot, and educating voters on how this all works.
Tom Perkins' piece is, once again, Michigan Dems receive more votes in the state house, but Republicans hold on to power. You'll find it at metrotimes.com. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President-elect Trump has been mighty busy on Twitter today, including firing a warning shot across the bow of General Motors. To quote Mr. Trump, General Motors is sending Mexican-made model of Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers tax-free across border. Make in USA or pay big border tax! Exclamation point. Michelle Krebs is senior analyst with Autotrader.com. Michelle, we know Mr. Trump made a lot of talk in the campaign promising he would slap a 35% tariff on Mexican-made vehicles. And a lot of his emphasis during the campaign was on Ford. What do you think about his tweet today aimed at GM?
I think it's GM's turn to be in his crosshairs. What we saw with Ford is Ford cut a deal with Donald Trump and agreed not to move the Lincoln MKC sport utility to Mexico as it had planned and keep it in Kentucky. So I'm wondering if we will see GM relent by moving the Chevrolet Cruze hatchback to the Lordstown, Ohio plant. So for background, the vehicle that is being discussed here is the Chevrolet Cruze hatchback, a very niche model that just came onto the market. It's made in Mexico. It's exported to other places. It comes to the U.S. It's a really small percentage of the total Chevrolet Cruze production, which is made in the Lordstown, Ohio plant.
So the Cruze sedan that most of us are used to seeing comes from Ohio.
Correct. It hasn't been selling all that well. It was beautifully redesigned this past year, but cars are just not that popular with consumers. And we saw huge incentives on that vehicle in December, and we've seen GM cut back production to lower inventories on that vehicle. So the hatchback part of it is just a tiny fraction.
And just to be clear, did I gather you say that's mainly for the global market?
It's made for the global market, but it comes to the U.S. from Mexico.
Do we have any idea how many come in to the U.S.? Just kind of wondering what triggered this tweet.
It just went on sale in the last few months. So I don't know what the numbers ultimately will be, but it'll be a low-volume vehicle.
So I guess how do we view this tweet? Misinformation? A lie? Agent provocateur?
I think it's probably maybe a bargaining chip, a warning note, but a lot of vehicles are made in Mexico and brought into the U.S., so I don't know why this one specifically. It's hard to guess. And the other thing is, I don't think there's this full understanding of what's going on in the automotive market, that consumers are choosing to buy sport utility vehicles, and they're turning away from traditional cars like the Chevrolet Cruze. What we have seen in this past year is heavy incentives on small cars, mid-sized cars, cars of all size. And so what automakers are trying to do is figure out ways to continue to offer those to consumers, but do it by cutting costs. And one of the ways you cut costs is you produce them in Mexico.
Michelle, we also saw today Ford announced it scrapped plans for its new $1.6 billion plant in Mexico and says it's going to add 700 jobs in Michigan to build electric autonomous vehicles. Now, was this in the works for a while before Mr. Trump's election, or would he be correct in somehow taking a bow for this?
What I found interesting about the Ford announcement is that they are going very heavy into electrification of vehicles. including hybrid versions of the F-150 pickup truck and the sporty Mustang. We have not seen consumers go to those vehicles. And, in fact, we've seen heavy incentives on hybrids and electric vehicles. So my concern is Ford's made this announcement. How are we going to get consumers to buy them? Now, some of this has to do with the fact that if you're going to sell vehicles in California, you have to have zero emissions. But, you know, the Trump administration has also talked about rolling back the 2025 fuel economy standards. So it's kind of an interesting announcement.
Interesting, I guess, is a good way to put it. And it certainly is stirring the pot. And at the same time, we know that GM's chairman and CEO is actually going to be on that council advising Mr. Trump on economic issues and job growth in just a few weeks, first week of February.
That's right. And so that's what makes this one interesting, that, you know, Mary Barra is an advisor on economic issues with the Trump administration. And I understand there's been a lot of talk back and forth between the two and some of her people with his people. It'll be interesting to see what results of this.
Michelle Krebs, senior analyst with Auto Trader. Always great to talk with you, Michelle. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What could AI, artificial intelligence, really mean for us in the future? And when might intelligent machines be at a point where they really become a part of our lives? Those are some of the questions that Michigan State University researcher Arend Hines explores, where he runs the Hines Lab. They research the evolution of natural and artificial intelligence. Turns out there are four distinct types of artificial intelligence. And Professor Hines is here with us now to break them down. Arend Hines, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Good to have you back with us. Tell us, how does evolution help with improving artificial intelligence systems?
Yeah, so there are pretty much two things that can be said about this. There's what I do, and then there's what lots of other people do. Let me talk about first how other people use evolution. What they do is called genetic algorithms, and they try to use genetic algorithms to create a better fit or a better classifiers to deal with data. What I do is I don't use a genetic algorithm. I use what's called digital life or digital evolution to evolve little virtual creatures that live in environments that pretty much look a little bit like a computer game to solve problems. The big discrepancy there is that there's an industry application, and that's what classifiers and deep learning does. And then there's what I do, and I try to understand how intelligence actually evolved. And that's why evolve virtual creatures in the computer to find out how that works.
And as you say in theconversation.com, the piece that you wrote for them, we need to do more than teach machines to learn. We need to overcome the boundaries that define the four different types of artificial intelligence. Help walk us through these four different types, starting with the type one AI of reactive machines. What does that mean?
Yeah, we have done lots and lots of progress on exactly these type 1 machines. A chess computer would fall into exactly that category. You present it with some data, then this chess computer computes the best possible move and spits out the answer. The computer knows nothing more than the board and has no internal state. It will play exactly the same move every time you ask them to evaluate the board again and again and again. And these machines that are type 1 pretty much have no memory that goes beyond the exact task that they're asking for, and are completely deterministically repeating what they do. And in order to understand this discrepancy, let's quickly look at type 2, because type 2, that's a very big step. These machines have internal states or representations about their environment that goes beyond what they are perceiving right now. They can remember things from the past, for example.
They have limited memory.
So, I mean, that's a little bit tricky because every computer has memory, but we have to define what memory means. You can have memory to do your computations. That's what the chess computer does. But you can also have memory to remember the past and then take the past into account to make current decisions. That is what having internal state or having memory about something in the past means. And if you have that, you decide differently.
How would this be applied? What kind of everyday use might we see this type 2 AI? Like in self-driving cars you mentioned in your piece?
Yeah, that's an example to explain that. I mean, these boundaries are not super strict, but we already have these type 2 machines, or at least some of them are type 2. A self-driving car evaluates pretty much at least a little bit about the past. It looks what other cars do, where they're coming from, where they're driving at, and then makes a decision. But a self-driving car will never remember, oh, this yellow car drove so badly, next time I have to have a further distance from it. That is something that would be a true type 2 machine. It has information about the past or about other entities in the environment, and will also change its behavior based on this. And In a self-driving car, you kind of don't want this. You want to have a machine that does exactly the same over and over again. And in order for self-driving cars to work, you need this second layer. You need information about the environment or the past or other objects around you, rather than just having sensorial inputs.
All right, let's move into this type 3 AI, theory of mind. What is that?
Yeah, these two first categories, type 1 and type 2, is something that Chris Adami, a friend of mine and colleague, presented at an A-Life meeting a while ago. A-Life meeting is artificial life meeting. We just worked on our paper about representations and how brains have representations about the environment, and these machines that have representations are type 2 machines. So he came up with this distinction between type 1 and type 2. And then we argued a little bit about this and said, we can extend this because we can not only measure that you have information, but we can measure what the information that you have is about. And if it's just about things around you, then you would fall in the type 2 category. However, if you have information about internal states of others, then you have type 3 intelligence. And let me explain this a little bit. If I interact with somebody, then I take into account the state of this other person. Is that other person angry, frightened, curious, bored, any of those things? And I know that this person is bored or that this person is curious or this person is frightened. That means I have information about the internal states of this other person. And in psychology or philosophy, this is called theory of mind. I know that the other thing has a mind on its own. It's not just an entity that does nothing else than whatever it does before.
And then finally into type 4 AI, self-awareness. Wow.
that's a pretty big leap. And the important point there is to have this distinction between type 3 and type 4 is that yet again, we can measure what the information that you have is about. And I think we can very easily interact with machines that have type 3 intelligence. They see that we are in need and they respond to what we have in need without us telling them, oh, feed me or drive me here or something like that. They can interact with us much easier. The real question is if they are self-aware and if they are then therefore fall in this fourth category. And we basically said, a type 4 machine is not only a machine that has information about something outside of it or about internal states of others, but it has information about its own internal states. And the argument or the example that I gave there is it's a very different thing to be hungry at noon or to know that I will be hungry at noon. Because if I know that I'll have internal states, I can actually much easier predict the future and also control the future, right? It's not just a surprise that this happens, but I can reflect on myself and I can project from whatever I experience to the future and then make much better decisions. And because these type 4 representations, these representations are about your own self, the moment you are at this topic of self-representations, you can just immediately call it consciousness. I'm not perfectly sure if this is true consciousness in that sense, because this is a very, very fishy term. But having representations about your own state is a very important step in that.
And I know you've been working on a test, Aaron, that determines whether a machine might fall into that type 3 category of AI. How does that test work?
Yeah. After we sort of laid out these four types of intelligence, of course, our question was, can we do this? Can we demonstrate the difference between those two types? And our earlier paper showed very nicely the difference between type 1 and type 2 machines. We had a task where the object, the robot that we controlled, has to catch the small ones, avoid the large ones. And it cannot do that without observing this for a while and forming representations about the concept of small or large. We evolved agents that can now do this, and we measured this, and we know, these machines now have representations, meaning information about the environment. And then we said, can we extend this? Can we create a test or at least an environment we can evolve machines that have this type 3 intelligence, knowing something about what the other person, so to speak, knows?
Aaron, where's the borderline between the AI machines that we have now, the artificial intelligence available to us now, and what is yet to come?
I think this is a big part of this article that I try to convey. The type 1 or type 2 machines that we have, and let's just look at them. This is pretty much Siri can recognize your voice. It's an awesome tool to have. Or self-driving cars. Or then there's Google AlphaGo that beat the Grandmaster in playing Go. And these are very, very awesome technological achievements. But these are what I would call type 1 machines. They don't learn from their past experience. Mm. I'm not supposed to interact with them beyond the purpose that they are designed for. And I was asking myself, if we continue this line of research, will they get me to the robots or to the intelligence that I'm interested in? And I have to say, I'm sort of born in the 70s, and that's when Star Wars came around. And I was looking at C-3PO and R2-D2, and I was like, wow, I would like to have or build these machines that are artificially intelligent, and they are their own personality and their own entities in the environment. And the current AI research that we have, which is deep learning and large classifiers or machine learning, is getting us more and more towards the machines that we already have, Google AlphaGo, but it's not a path to these robots that I'm looking for. What's the difference? And the difference is that I'm not trying to construct something from scratch. I'm trying to evolve these artificial intelligences, because evolution is the process that already gave rise to our intelligence. So why not just recapitulate this and try to get them intelligence through that method?
It certainly seems like those of us who watch Westworld on HBO are thinking of that type 4 AI. Did that ring bells for you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this, I saw in that time the original Westworld. I haven't seen the new series yet. But you're absolutely right. As far as I understand this, these machines reflect about themselves, and they're definitely type 4 intelligence. And quite frankly, that has to result in some kind of conflict, because if you have a type 4 machine that is self-aware, you cannot just boss it around or give it commands, because, well, it's sort of sentient already. So the moment we have type 4 intelligent machines, we have to rethink the whole way how we use or how we apply them, or how we negotiate, how to pretty much live with them together rather than make them a new cast of slaves, because we definitely don't want that.
But I'm finding myself, being the baby boomer I am, thinking of HAL in 2001.
Yeah. The interesting part here is that HAL is what we would call an expert system that probably is a type 1 or poorly designed type 2 machines, because what HAL is a collection of rules and statements. And what it does is it compares the environment with these statements. I mean, I can give a very deep psychological analysis on HAL, but it boils down to the following. HAL thinks it doesn't make mistakes. And then these two humans suddenly tell him, oh, there's a mistake in your APU whatever unit. And obviously that means that HAL has conflicting information. The people outside tell him, you are broken. And HAL has a sentence in it that says, you are perfect. And HAL resolves this by killing the people, right?
Yes.
And this is a terrible thing. And this is sort of the hallmark, or epitomizes what the danger is of designing intelligent machines instead of evolving them. Because what the designers of HAL, I mean, okay, that's a sci-fi movie, okay?
Yes, yes.
But if I would do it, right, I would actually write lots and lots of commands and a very, very complicated set of pieces and parts that interact and build a very complex machine from the bottom up. And then I get unintended consequences. It's the same thing that we see with all major disasters. Look at Chernobyl, right? They designed a very complex system, but didn't think about all the opportunities. And when you do this one thing that it wasn't designed for, it blows up. Mm. So if you build machines from the bottom up, from these base rules, you create things that you cannot predict and control anymore, and then they don't function. This is one reason why we say, okay, let's not do that mistake. First of all, we don't know how to do it. And secondly, we have these unintended consequences. So instead, let's just evolve these machines in environments, because evolution made machines that don't have these catastrophic effects or breakdowns, or maybe only in a much, much smaller percentage.
Fascinating work being done at Michigan State University by Erin Hintz, who's Assistant Professor of Integrative Biology and Computer Science and Engineering. And you can find his story on understanding the four types of AI by going to theconversation.com. Erin, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Take care.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President-elect Trump has been mighty busy on Twitter today, including firing a warning shot across the bow of General Motors. To quote Mr. Trump, General Motors is sending Mexican-made model of Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers tax-free across border. Make in USA or pay big border tax! Exclamation point. Michelle Krebs is senior analyst with Autotrader.com. Michelle, we know Mr. Trump made a lot of talk in the campaign promising he would slap a 35% tariff on Mexican-made vehicles. And a lot of his emphasis during the campaign was on Ford. What do you think about his tweet today aimed at GM?
I think it's GM's turn to be in his crosshairs. What we saw with Ford Ford cut a deal with Donald Trump and agreed not to move the Lincoln MKC sport utility to Mexico as it had planned and keep it in Kentucky. So I'm wondering if we will see GM relent by moving the Chevrolet Cruze hatchback to the Lordstown, Ohio plant. So for background, the vehicle that is being discussed here is the Chevrolet Cruze hatchback, a very niche model that just came onto the market. It's made in Mexico. It's exported to other places. It comes to the U.S. It's a really small percentage of the total Chevrolet Cruze production, which is made in the Lordstown, Ohio plant.
So the Cruze sedan that most of us are used to seeing comes from Ohio.
Correct. It hasn't been selling all that well. It was beautifully redesigned this past year, but cars are just not that popular with consumers. And we saw huge incentives on that vehicle in December, and we've seen GM cut back production to lower inventories on that vehicle. So the hatchback part of it is just a tiny fraction.
And just to be clear, did I gather you say that's mainly for the global market?
It's made for the global market, but it comes to the U.S. from Mexico.
Do we have any idea how many come in to the U.S.? Just kind of wondering what triggered this tweet.
It just went on sale in the last few months. So I don't know what the numbers ultimately will be, but it'll be a low-volume vehicle.
So I guess how do we view this tweet? Misinformation? A lie? Agent provocateur?
I think it's probably maybe a bargaining chip, a warning note, but a lot of vehicles are made in Mexico and brought into the U.S., so I don't know why this one specifically. It's hard to guess. And the other thing is I don't think there's this full understanding of what's going on in the automotive market, that consumers are choosing to buy sport utility vehicles, and they're turning away from traditional cars like the Chevrolet Cruze. What we have seen in this past year is heavy incentives on small cars, mid-sized cars, cars of all size. And so what automakers are trying to do is figure out ways to continue to offer those to consumers, but do it by cutting costs. And one of the ways you cut costs is you produce them in Mexico.
Michelle, we also saw today Ford announced it scrapped plans for its new $1.6 billion plant in Mexico and says it's going to add 700 jobs in Michigan to build electric autonomous vehicles. Now, was this in the works for a while before Mr. Trump's election, or would he be correct in somehow taking a bow for this?
What I found interesting about the Ford announcement is that they're going very heavy into electrification of vehicles, including hybrid versions of the F-150 pickup truck and the sporty Mustang. We have not seen consumers go to those vehicles. And in fact, we've seen heavy incentives on hybrids and electric vehicles. So my concern is Ford's made this announcement. How are we going to get consumers to buy them? Now, some of this has to do with the fact that if you're going to sell vehicles in California, you have to have zero emissions. But, you know, the Trump administration has also talked about rolling back the 2025 fuel economy standards. So it's kind of an interesting announcement.
Interesting, I guess, is a good way to put it, and it certainly is stirring the pot. And at the same time, we know that GM's chairman and CEO is actually going to be on that council advising Mr. Trump on economic issues and job growth in just a few weeks, first week of February.
That's right. And so that's what makes this one interesting, that, you know, Mary Barra is an advisor on economic issues with the Trump administration, and I understand there's been a lot of talk back and forth between the two and some of her people with his people. It'll be interesting to see what results of this.
Michelle Krebs, senior analyst with Auto Trader. Always great to talk with you, Michelle. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What could AI, artificial intelligence, really mean for us in the future? And when might intelligent machines be at a point where they really become a part of our lives? Those are some of the questions that Michigan State University researcher Arend Hines explores, where he runs the Hines Lab. They research the evolution of natural and artificial intelligence. Turns out there are four distinct types of artificial intelligence, and Professor Hines is here with us now to break them down. Arend Hines, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Good to have you back with us. Tell us, how does evolution help with improving artificial intelligence systems?
Yeah. So there are pretty much two things that can be said about this. There's what I do, and then there's what lots of other people do. Let me talk about first how other people use evolution. What they do is called genetic algorithms, and they try to use genetic algorithms to create a better fit or a better classifiers to deal with data. What I do is I don't use a genetic algorithm. I use what's called digital life or digital evolution to evolve little virtual creatures that live in environments that pretty much look a little bit like a computer game to solve problems. The big discrepancy there is that there's an industry application, and that's what classifiers and deep learning does. And then there's what I do, and I try to understand how intelligence actually evolved. And that's why evolve virtual creatures in the computer to find out how that works.
And as you say in theconversation.com, the piece that you wrote for them, we need to do more than teach machines to learn. We need to overcome the boundaries that define the four different types of artificial intelligence. Help walk us through these four different types, starting with the type one AI of reactive machines. What does that mean?
Yeah, we have done lots and lots of progress on exactly these type one machines. A chess computer would fall into exactly that category. You present it with some data, then this chess computer computes the best possible move and spits out the answer. The computer knows nothing more than the board and has no internal state. It will play exactly the same move every time you ask them to evaluate the board again and again and again. And these machines that are type one pretty much have no memory that goes beyond the exact task that they're asking for, and they're completely deterministically repeating what they do. And in order to understand this discrepancy, let's quickly look at type two, because type two, that's a very big step. These machines have internal states or representations about their environment that goes beyond what they are perceiving right now. They can remember things from the past, for example.
They have limited memory.
So, I mean, that's a little bit tricky because every computer has memory, but we have to define what memory means. You can have memory to do your computations. That's what the chess computer does. But you can also have memory to remember the past and then take the past into account to make current decisions. That is what having internal state or having memory about something in the past means. And if you have that, you decide differently.
How would this be applied? What kind of everyday use might we see this type 2 AI? Like in self-driving cars you mentioned in your piece?
Yeah, that's an example to explain that. I mean, these boundaries are not super strict, but we already have these type 2 machines, or at least some of them are type 2. A self-driving car evaluates pretty much at least a little bit about the past. It looks what other cars do, where they're coming from, where they're driving at, and then makes a decision. But a self-driving car will never remember, oh, this yellow car drove so badly, next time I have to have a further distance from it. That is something that would be a true type 2 machine. It has information about the past or about other entities in the environment, and will also change its behavior based on this. And in a self-driving car, you kind of don't want this. You want to have a machine that does exactly the same over and over again. And in order for self-driving cars to work, you need this second layer. You need information about the environment or the past or other objects around you, rather than just having sensorial inputs.
All right, let's move into this type 3 AI, theory of mind. What is that?
Yeah, these two first categories, type 1 and type 2, is something that Chris Adami, a friend of mine and colleague, presented at an A-Life meeting a while ago. A-Life meeting is artificial life meeting. We just worked on our paper about representations and how brains have representations about the environment, and these machines that have representations are type 2 machines. So he came up with this distinction between type 1 and type 2. And then we argued a little bit about this and said, we can extend this because we can not only measure that you have information, but we can measure what the information that you have is about. And if it's just about things around you, then you would fall in the type 2 category. However, if you have information about internal states of others, then you have type 3 intelligence. And let me explain this a little bit. If I interact with somebody, then I take into account the state of this other person. Is that other person angry, frightened, curious, bored, any of those things? And I know that this person is bored or that this person is curious or this person is frightened. That means I have information about the internal states of this other person. And in psychology or philosophy, this is called theory of mind. I know that the other thing has a mind on its own. It's not just an entity that does nothing else than whatever it does before.
And then finally into type 4 AI, self-awareness. Wow.
Yeah, that's a pretty big leap. And the important point there is to have this distinction between type 3 and type 4 is that yet again, we can measure what the information that you have is about. And I think we can very easily interact with machines that have type 3 intelligence. They see that we are in need and they respond to what we have in need without us telling them, oh, feed me or drive me here or something like that. They can interact with us much easier. The real question is if they are self-aware and if they are then therefore fall in this fourth category. And we basically said, oh, a type 4 machine is not only a machine that has information about something outside of it or about internal states of others, but it has information about its own internal states. And the argument or the example that I gave there is it's a very different thing to be hungry at noon or to know that I will be hungry at noon. Because if I know that I'll have internal states, I can actually much easier predict the future and also control the future, right? It's not just a surprise that this happens, but I can reflect on myself and I can project from whatever I experience to the future and then make much better decisions. And because these type 4 representations, these representations are about your own self, the moment you are at this topic of self-representations, you can just immediately call it consciousness. I'm not perfectly sure if this is true consciousness in that sense, because this is a very, very fishy term. But having representations about your own state is a very important step in that.
And I know you've been working on a test, Aaron, that determines whether a machine might fall into that type 3 category of AI. How does that test work?
Yeah. After we sort of laid out these four types of intelligence, of course, our question was, oh, can we do this? Can we demonstrate the difference between those two types? And our earlier paper showed very nicely the difference between type 1 and type 2 machines. We had a task where the object, the robot that we controlled, has to catch the small ones, avoid the large ones. And it cannot do that without observing this for a while and forming representations about the concept of small or large. We evolved agents that can now do this, and we measured this, and we know, okay, these machines now have representations, meaning information about the environment. And then we said, okay, can we extend this? Can we create a test or at least an environment we can evolve machines that have this type 3 intelligence, knowing something about what the other person, so to speak, knows?
Aaron, where's the borderline between the AI machines that we have now, the artificial intelligence available to us now, and what is yet to come?
Yeah, I think this is a big part of this article that I try to convey. The type 1 or type 2 machines that we have, and let's just look at them. This is pretty much Siri can recognize your voice. It's an awesome tool to have, or self-driving cars. Or then there's Google AlphaGo that beat the Grandmaster in playing Go. And these are very, very awesome technological achievements. But these are what I would call type 1 machines. They don't learn from their past experience. Mm. I'm not supposed to interact with them beyond the purpose that they are designed for. And I was asking myself, if we continue this line of research, will they get me to the robots or to the intelligence that I'm interested in? And I have to say, I'm sort of born in the 70s, and that's when Star Wars came around. And I was looking at C-3PO and R2-D2, and I was like, wow, I would like to have or build these machines that are artificially intelligent, and they are their own personality and their own entities in the environment. And the current AI research that we have, which is deep learning and large classifiers or machine learning, is getting us more and more towards the machines that we already have, Google AlphaGo, but it's not a path to these robots that I'm looking for. What's the difference? And the difference is that I'm not trying to construct something from scratch. I'm trying to evolve these artificial intelligences because evolution is the process that already gave rise to our intelligence. So why not just recapitulate this and try to get them intelligence through that method?
It certainly seems like those of us who watch Westworld on HBO are thinking of that type 4 AI. Did that ring bells for you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I saw in that time the original Westworld. I haven't seen the new series yet. But you're absolutely right. As far as I understand this, these machines reflect about themselves, and they're definitely type 4 intelligence. And quite frankly, that has to result in some kind of conflict, because if you have a type 4 machine that is self-aware, you cannot just boss it around or give it commands because, well, it's sort of sentient already. So the moment we have type 4 intelligent machines, we have to rethink the whole way how we use or how we apply them or how we negotiate how to pretty much live with them together rather than make them a new cast of slaves, because we definitely don't want that.
But I'm finding myself, being the baby boomer, I am thinking of HAL in 2001.
Yeah. The interesting part here is that HAL is what we would call an expert system that probably is a type 1 or poorly designed type 2 machines, because what HAL is a collection of rules and statements. And what it does is it compares the environment with these statements. I mean, I can give a very deep psychological analysis on hell, but it boils down to the following. Hell thinks it doesn't make mistakes. And then these two humans suddenly tell him, oh, there's a mistake in your APU whatever unit. And obviously that means that hell has conflicting information. The people outside tell him, you are broken. And hell has a sentence in it that says, you are perfect. And hell resolves this by killing the people. Right?
Yes.
And this is a terrible thing. And this is sort of the hallmark or epitomizes what the danger is of designing intelligent machines instead of evolving them. Because what the designers of hell, I mean, okay, that's a sci-fi movie, okay?
Yes, yes.
But if I would do it, right, I would actually write lots and lots of commands and a very, very complicated set of pieces and parts that interact and build a very complex machine from the bottom up. And then I get unintended consequences. It's the same thing that we see with all major disasters. Look at Chernobyl, right? They designed a very complex system, but didn't think about all the opportunities. And when you do this one thing that it wasn't designed for, it blows up. Mm. So if you build machines from the bottom up, from these base rules, you create things that you cannot predict and control anymore, and then they don't function. This is one reason why we say, okay, let's not do that mistake. First of all, we don't know how to do it. And secondly, we have these unintended consequences. So instead, let's just evolve these machines in environments, because evolution made machines that don't have these catastrophic effects or breakdowns, or maybe only in a much, much smaller percentage.
Fascinating work being done at Michigan State University by Erend Hintz, who's assistant professor of integrative biology and computer science and engineering. And you can find his story on understanding the four types of AI by going to theconversation.com. Erend, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Take care.
Today's program was directed by Ellie Billings, and our engineer is Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.